That was a great song, wasn't it?
Yes.
When the wedding bells ring. Have you ever thought about that?
Yes.
Never occurred to me. That's never occurred to me before. Well done to the worship group. Thought that was excellent. Well done. At home, I've got a letter that was written to me, written by my grandfather to his mother during the First World War. He signed up to fight at age 14. He forged his age, and he ended up fighting on the Russian front. The letter gives no details where he was because that wasn't allowed, and it's written in a language of a bygone age. It's difficult to imagine the conditions in which my grandfather wrote that letter. The squalor, the pain, the fear, the not knowing if he'd ever go home again. It's a precious thing, that letter. When I was about 7 years old, my mum was in hospital for a long time. She was always in hospital, but she was in for a long time when I was about seven. I think she was about 2 months, and she was very sick. And my dad would visit Walton Hospital every night. Children weren't allowed in those days. You remember that. Anyway, one night, when he'd come home from work and he'd have to have a quick tea and then go out, he said, son, why don't you write a letter to your mum to cheer her up? So I did. Now, I don't remember asking my mum how she was. I don't remember saying I hoped that she would soon be better. What I do remember is writing, dear mum, do you remember saying that you would buy me a blue bubble car in Woolworths for a shilling when you come out of hospital? From your loving son, John. True. My mum wrote back, dear John, of course I remember. And when I come home, that's the first thing we'll do. Tell Gladys on the toy counter to put one away for us in case they sell out. You be good for your dad and I'll be home soon. Lots of love, son. Good night and God bless. Mum. Now, I know that's what my mum wrote because I've still got that letter. It's a precious thing, that letter. We all like receiving letters, though very few people write letters. I know you. I've known you all for 25 years. You don't write letters. I do, and I never get any back from you. Anyway, that's my gripe. It's a precious thing, writing letters, but it's mostly a dying art. A church minister and his wife sent their 18-year-old daughter off to Oxford University with great hopes for her future. After a couple of months, they received a letter from her which read, "Dearest Mum and Dad, I trust this letter finds you both in good health. I am all right, and a lot has happened in the past couple of months. I now have a boyfriend. He is 50 years old and is a DJ in a local nightclub called The Dark Side. My boyfriend's name is Growler, and all of the girls in the club love him, but he says he loves me best. I go to The Dark Side most nights now, as it is such fun, so I've stopped going to lectures. Growler says, who needs education anyway when tequila shots are all you need? Anyway, I've moved in with him now. I had to, as Growler accidentally set fire to my digs with a firework when we were having an all-night rave in my place. So, I've dropped out of uni, and Growler and I are going to Ibiza to join the party scene. He says we can crash in his friend's pad. We leave tomorrow. Oh, and I'm pregnant. From your loving daughter, Penelope. P.S. None of the above actually happened, but I wanted you to keep things in perspective as I actually need £100 for the dress for the Christmas ball. Letters can be precious things. Especially letters written to us by those who care for us, who love us, who want the best for our lives. Letters are more than paper and ink, much more. They're an expression of one heart saying to another, you're loved, I care. This is my way of showing it. And for the past 5 weeks, we've been looking at a letter together from our elder brother James, who one day we will meet. Isn't that interesting? One day we'll meet James. He's one of my heroes. It's one of my heroes in the faith, James. If he was to come from anywhere on earth, it'd be Kirby. Really, he's just a man I like. He's in your face. He talks straight. and he's our elder brother. And I want to tell you something, church. He didn't have to write this letter. He could not have bothered to write a letter on a piece of parchment in those days. It was a very time-consuming and costly affair. To send it wasn't just a matter of putting a stamp on it and putting it in the box. There was no Royal Mail, no FedEx. Someone had to carry this letter through all weathers at some risk across hundreds of miles. Someone had to pay for the food and lodging along the way. Someone had to pay for the ship fares. So James could have decided not to bother to write it at all. But he did bother. He did bother. And this letter from your elder brother is a precious, precious thing. And it's precious for a number of reasons. First, it's precious because the letter is written by James, but it's inspired by God. It's first and foremost God's letter to us. This is God speaking to us through James. That should cause us to look in wonder at the paper and ink in our hands. It's not a book of theology. It's a letter from our Father in heaven. It's a letter from Abba to us. Second, the writer is James, Jesus' half-brother, the man who knew Jesus better than any man who ever lived. James the Just, the leader of the church in Jerusalem. This man didn't play at religion. He gave his very life for the King of Kings, for soon after he wrote this letter, he would be executed. That should cause you to look in wonder at the paper and ink in your hands. And third, as well as the original recipients, this letter was written for you. God had you in mind when this letter was written. Isn't that great? When this man scratched the ink on the parchment 2,000 years ago, God had Brian in mind, and Myra in mind, and little Abel in mind. God had them in mind. This is for you. It's for your instruction, for your correction, for your encouragement, for your guidance, for your growth, for your health, for your wisdom, for your understanding, to help you become all that God intends. How did we ever see it just as a book to look at for an hour on a Sunday and throw in a cupboard to gather dust through the week? How do we ever arrive at that point as churches? I'll never know. You know, as my mum wrote to me at the beginning of my letter, "Dear John," so at the beginning of the letter of James, you could write your name, "Dear George, dear Frank, dear Rosie." This is for you. This is for you. And at the end, where my mum wrote, "Lots of love, son," you could write, "Lots of love, son. Lots of love, daughter. Abba. Abba." See, if you just treated the past 5 weeks as an interesting theological study without asking the questions, what is God saying through this and what am I going to do about it? You've missed the point. I've wasted my time. What if you're thinking, well, we've done James now, Pastor, we can tick that off. What's next? Wrong again. See, God's not so much interested in how much knowledge you attain in this life. He's not so much interested in what you do, is in who you are becoming. That's what God watches with focus. Who is Carl becoming? Because if you just hear God's word every week, every month, a year upon year, but you don't do what it says, what use is that? What use is that? But God has given us his word so that we can move on, change, grow, become more Christ-like. God's great hope is that we grow up and mature and become more like his son inside. It's what he wants for your life. You might want a big conservatory and a flash car and a new suit and a big cruise. That's not God's interest. God wants you to become more Christ-like. So he gives you his book, his word. He wants us to grow up and to mature. Do you know why that is? Because then God can share the deep things of his heart with his grown-up children. It's great to see Abel and James lighting those candles. I hope in 20 years' time, they're lighting the candles there, and then we can share the deep things of our hearts with them, don't you? Isn't that your hope, both churches? that they grow up to be fine young men that makes a difference in this world. It's the same for our Father in heaven. He has this hope that we grow up, that we mature. And the more we grow and mature, the more he will open his heart to us. So he's given us his book. He's given us this letter, this precious, precious letter. And as we come to the end of the letter, you can imagine James in his room in Jerusalem. The candle's flickering. His body is aching. It's aging. His mind is full of passion for churches, most of which he'll never see. Think about that. He'll never see. He'll never visit. And he's thinking, how am I going to conclude this letter? This the only letter he'd ever write. And the pressure was intense in Jerusalem. He knew time was short. He knew soon, you know, they're going to get me. I knew I'm not going to die naturally. James knew that. The religious authorities would get me. Maybe the Romans, but probably the religious authorities, as it would be. And so he sits with the candle flickering to conclude the letter that you have on your lap. And I'll tell you this about James. You know, when you come to the end of your life, you don't talk about trivial stuff. I've stood at the bedside of too many people as they've left this life, and they don't talk about trivial stuff. Trust me. Ruth would know this. Ruth's been there in her occupation. People don't talk about trivial stuff when they've only got a few minutes left. You talk about what's important. So James isn't going to write about the weather or the stock exchange or the football results. He begins this section of his letter in a way that can only be described as seething. It's so fierce. Look at the first line. It's so fierce that Upton Sinclair is a novelist and a social reformer in the States. And he once read a paraphrase of this section to a group of politicians in America. But he attributed it to a woman called Emma Goldman, who was an anarchist and an agitator. When he read this section and a paraphrase, the ministers were so enraged, they declared she should be deported. And it was James's words. It's strong stuff. And James writes, now listen, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that's coming upon you. Your wealth is rotted and moths have eaten your clothes. The gold and silver is corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You've hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workmen are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. That's a powerful verse. That should stop you in your tracks. It's strong stuff. Now, actually, James' words were aimed at the wealthy, non-believing countrymen who were exploiting the poor, many of whom were in the church, the poor. And specifically, James' targets were wealthy farmers. They owned large tracts of land, and they were squeezing everyone and everything for profits. So James just erupts. I like the guy. I've worked with men like this, have you? It just erupts. And he says, Luke, and the word Luke in the Greek is just as strong as it gets. He almost grabs them by the throat. He says, look, the wages you failed to pay the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. And this was a heinous crime for two reasons. First, the poverty-stricken workers would live in hand-to-mouth. A day without wages was a day without food. This mattered. Second, the owners were doing this at harvest time when their barns were full and their wine vats were overflowing. So imagine an employer at a harvest Thanksgiving service, not like we do now and again. The table at the altar is laden with goods, and he's singing, now thank we all our God with hearts and hands and voices, who wondrous things have done, in whom this world rejoices, while his employees cannot even afford food for the table at home. I don't think this hasn't happened. This isn't just confined to a Dickens novel. In fact, it's one of the reasons evangelist Vincent van Gogh gave up the faith. Did you know that? He was an evangelist one time, and the reason he gave up his faith is because he saw this in action. He saw the rich exploiting the poor. That's why he gave up his Christian faith. Today, if we don't consider the poor, it's the same thing. The poor matter. We're surrounded in the world by poor. The poor matter today. It's a serious sin. And let me show you something really interesting that James writes there. He says, two cries go up to heaven. This really happened. Two actual cries. The first, he says, is the cry of unpaid wages from the bank accounts of the rich. And they go up like the blood of Abel in Genesis chapter 4. A real cry goes from the bank accounts of the rich man. Isn't that interesting? That's what James says. Can you get your mind around that? So the man's got a bank account with money he should have paid to the poor. And James says, the money cries out from the bank and that cry goes to heaven. And if you read it in the original language, the word cries out is the same as the cry of an expelled demon. It's like a piercing shriek. It demands vengeance. In other words, money talks. Neil Diamond sung a song like that, didn't he, once? Money talks. James is telling you. So the rich man thinks, I'll just keep the money in the bank. The poor can stay poor and unfed. And money talks. The blood of Abel talks. You don't get away with anything in this life, folks. The other cries are shout from the workers. And those two cries do not go unheard, for they reach the ears of the Lord Almighty. Isn't that incredible? He's not sitting doing stuff in Australia or thinking about the cosmos and should he move Andromeda slightly to the left. Those two cries reach his ears, says James. The ears of the Lord Almighty. Literally, the Lord of hosts is the translation. Important word. The hosts are the angelic armies of heaven. And this is the name that the young David invoked when he stood before Goliath and said, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin. I come against you in the name of the Lord of hosts. It's a martial name, a military term. The king of the army of heaven. This mighty, awesome, magnificent God. This all-powerful king. That's who heard these cries. Do you understand what he's saying? Those cries were heard by the king of the army of heaven. And these words are not just for rich landowners. They're for you and I. How we treat the poor masses. It really matters. Because God is watching. The king is watching. How we use our resources matters because the king is watching. So don't waste that which God has given you. You get one life. Use that for the king. There's a woman called Bertha Adams, and she was 71 years old when she died alone in West Palm Beach, Florida, on Easter Sunday in 1976. The coroner's report read, I'll read the words, cause of death, malnutrition. In Florida. After wasting away to 4 stone, she could no longer stay alive. When the authorities visited her home, they found, and I quote, a pig pen, the biggest mess you can imagine. One seasoned inspector said he had never seen a home in greater disarray. Bertha had begged food from neighbors and got her clothes from a Salvation Army. She appeared a pitiful and forgotten widow. But amid the jumble of her unclean, disheveled belongings, two keys were found, which led officials to safety deposit boxes at two banks. The first box contained over 700 AT&T stock certificates, plus hundreds of other valuable certificates, and a stack of cash totaling $200,000. The second box contains over $600,000. Both boxes were worth over $1 million in total. Bertha Adams' hoarding was tragic. Her great wealth did her no good whatsoever. Used properly, it could have meant good health for her and many others. So what's the lesson for us today, churches? Well, it's quite simply that while the Bible doesn't discourage saving and providential provision for one's needs, it's dead set against the vast accumulation of self-directed wealth focused solely on perpetuating your own comforts and pleasures. This is not home. If you were to go to a hotel tonight on a journey, would you spend all that you had on a hotel room? That was a question. Would you? So say you're taking a journey from here to Scotland and you stopped off halfway and your hotel room was like, would you spend everything you had on a hotel room? No. You wouldn't spend a penny on it. You'd just make do. This is a hotel room. This isn't home. You make do. What you do is you send accumulated treasures up to heaven. You look after the poor. You love one another. You take care of your neighbor next door. You go out of your way to help those for whom life is really hard. You don't do what Bertha Adams did and hoard your stuff. Because when some pastor stands by your coffin, I'll tell you this, you don't take anything with you. So James has a go at them and he says, you know, you only get one life. Use it wisely. Jesus was very clear about this when he said, don't store up for yourself treasure on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourself treasures in heaven where moth and rust don't destroy, where thieves don't break in and steal. For where your treasure is, that's where your heart's going to be. Where's your treasure? In a local bank? In your stuff? What in the kingdom of heaven? What have you sent up there recently? Christ stands at the bar of the world today as he stood at the days of old. Let each man tax his soul and say, shall I again my Lord betray for my greed or my goods or my gold? Use wisely that which the king has given you. And there was a good reason for doing this. As James reminds us, the king will return in verse 7. The king will return. In fact, in the New Testament, there's over 300 references to the fact that one day King Jesus will return. The Bible couldn't be clearer. The king is coming back. You know that. The king is coming back. And he's not coming back to stand you before him at the bema seat to take an inventory of how much stuff you accumulated. He's not. He's not the least bit interested in your bank book or your Mazda car or the rest of your stuff. He's not even coming back to see what you did. He's coming back to see who you became. That's what he's interested in. He's going to stand me before his throne and say, son, let's see who you became. So on your present life trajectory, if it continues as it is, who are you becoming if you don't change anything? Who will you present before Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, if he came back today? Did you become a person of love? Did you become a person of truth, a person of prayer, a person who had a generous heart towards the poor? Were you a person of faith, a person who kept the word? Were you a person known in heaven and feared in hell? He will want to know, who did you become? And there will be no debate about the answer to that question. Because he will know exactly before he asks you, and you will know exactly before you answer. Who did you become? Churches, the king is coming back. You know, one night this week at midnight, I was in intensive care with Ian. And we were praying for someone and reading scripture to them. And they were very ill. Seriously ill. It was about 2 a.m. and it was very quiet except for the background hum of the machines. And for a few moments I looked around at the 4 or 5 other beds. Each of one contained a seriously ill person with a one-to-one nurse. And I noticed something in that ITU unit. I noticed that around each bed, each patient had no personal goods. No fridge, no flat screen TV, no bank book, no certificates, no three-piece suites, no wardrobe, no clothes, no computer, no mobile, nothing. There was just them as they hovered between this life and eternity. And that's how it will be for you and me. When you leave this life, you will just take you with you. The you you became. That's it. The you you became. And that moment, says James, could be at any time. The king could come at any time. Why do we live with the illusion I've got 70 years or more? Because two people I know thought that last Sunday they had 70 years and didn't. The church has always believed Jesus would return at some point soon. They did in James. They just didn't know when he would return. They just believed it. They thought it would be soon. But some said, well, it's been a while. He hasn't come back yet. Maybe the church was mistaken. But the Apostle Peter answered that one when he said, don't forget this one thing. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promises. Some understand slowness. That's why James said, you be patient, church. Be patient. None of the apostles predicted that Jesus would return their lifetime. Even Jesus himself said he didn't know the day or the hour. And you must realize that the term near is a relative term. Nature provides an illustration of that. If you think of the life of a mayfly, it's at Ephraim. It lives exactly one day. Believe it or not, there's a creature that lives just one day, a mayfly. It's bad luck if it's a day like today, like, but it just lives one day. Now, suppose a mayfly is hovering over a pool for the one spring day of its life. Suppose it's capable of observing a tadpole over this pool. If the mayfly in the mayfly's aged afternoon, having seen no change in the tadpole, it'd be impossible for the mayfly to conceive that the tadpole's becoming a frog was very near. So it is with our mayfly existence in Christ's calendar. Our short day doesn't negate the coming of the closeness of his coming. Because similarly to a child, in November, Christmas is an eternity away, is it not? To an aged, white-haired grandmother who's weathered the snows of many winters and countless trips to the shops, Christmas isn't just near, it's just around the corner. Some of you know the feeling already. The older you get, the faster time seems to race by, does it not? Just this week, I got a nice letter from the government saying, now you're a pensioner, you can have a cold weather payment on us. So, Pastor, keep warm and don't forget to wear your thermals. So, I made that last bit up. But I can't get my head around the word pensioner. I thought that just applied to other people, not like old people. I can't believe, in the blink of an eye, I'm 65. Can't believe it. See, near is relative. So when James says Christ's coming is near, he's writing as one who's been taught to see the years of his life according to the unbeginning, unending eternity of God. And you remember this, churches. The Apostle John, writing at the very end of his life, at the very end of Christ's book, wrote 3 times, behold, I am coming soon. Behold, I am coming soon. Yes, I am coming soon. Almost the last words of Christ. The conclusion is inescapable. We are to live as God's people with a deep awareness that the King is to come soon. That's how we live. How we live matters. That's how we love. How we love matters. That's how we become who God wants us to become. The King's watching, folks. The King is coming soon. So the conclusion of the letter from your elder brother James is, finish well. No matter how you've done so far, no matter how many times you've stumbled or fallen, no matter how many times you've let the Lord or others down, you determine from now on, I'm going to finish well. You up for that? Yeah. From this day on, past is gone. From this day on, I am going to finish well. It might be tonight the King comes back. But one day I'll stand before him. I am determined from this day, I am going to finish well. I am going to waste no more of this one and only life. I'm going to finish well. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind, says the Bible. Because only as you are changed will you see other people changed. And that's James' final challenge to us in his letter. He concludes by saying, whoever turns a sinner from the error of his way will save him from death and cover a multitude of sins. You know what James is saying? As you journey home, bring others with you. Yes. Isn't that a great way to finish a letter? I love the fact that he almost stops. It's an unusual ending. He almost stops. He's basically saying, I've taught you now through the letter. You've been taught now for 5 weeks. What's the conclusion? As we journey home to see the King, bring others with you. Old Rome Baptist, Liverpool Life Fellowship, bring others with you. Time is short. Bring others with you. This whole letter is to help you grow as a disciple so you can grow other disciples. Life isn't about you. It's about the difference you can make in other people's lives. It's about you becoming part of the process to help other people become disciples of Jesus. To introduce someone to Jesus, to help them to grow up in the knowledge of him, is the greatest thing one human being can do for another. It really is. And that's why James has been so hard-hitting in the letter. People's eternal lives are on the line. So he calls all of us, finish well. Finish well. So let's determine from this day to pray more for our family and friends who don't yet know Jesus. Remember, the King is coming soon. Let's have the faith to start inviting them to church, both churches. Let's have the faith to start inviting those we know to church. Yeah? Yeah? Let's start coming to the prayer meeting as tonight, as the world gets darker. Let's turn the light up bright in this place. Let's not have this place in darkness when the King comes back. Because it could be. We could get caught out with this one. Let's start having the courage to share our faith more openly while opportunity arises, because time is short. And remember this, final thought. You might not have £30 billion to give away, like Mark Zuckerberg did this week on Facebook. £30 billion. You might not have £30 billion to give away, but you've got the gospel to share. The gospel which can turn a sinner from the error of his ways, save him from death, and cover a multitude of sins. All of you? You're more than billionaires. You're children of the Most High God. Go and take what you have. Go and bring them home. Go and finish well. For God's sake, for the King's sake. Go and bring them home.